Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori on this Saturday morning. How are we doing this morning? So glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning right here on WLIW 88.3 FM Southampton, serving Eastern Long Island and Southern Connecticut, 96.9 in Western Suffolk, and streaming at wliw.org/radio and on your favorite streaming platforms. And each show is archived on my website at annliguori.com. That's annliguori.com. And distributed on my podcast via Audio Boom and iTunes. Well, this morning I talk about the Senate hearing in which Senators Richard Blumenthal and Ron Johnson quiz PGA Tour COO Ron Price and PGA Tour Policy Board member Jimmy Dunn about the proposed agreement between the PGA Tour and the Saudi Public Investment Fund, that's PIF. Longtime radio and TV golf broadcaster Dave Marr joins me to discuss several of the major points of the agreement. When pressed by Senator Blumenthal on what the investment from the Saudis may look like, PGA Tour COO Ron Price replied, in quotes, north of $1 billion. Well, there are so many unanswered questions. The PGA Tour insists that the PGA Tour would remain in control. But would that really be the case, I ask, with the Saudis becoming the majority investor? And will the players be able to trust PGA Tour Commissioner Jay Monahan again after the PGA Tour literally did a 180 in their dealings with the Saudis? They were completely against it and really banned every PGA Tour player that bolted from the PGA Tour to LIV Golf, owned by the Saudis. And Commissioner Jay Monahan just hated everything there was to hate about LIV Golf, and now he wants to be in business with them. So, of course, it was a huge betrayal. The players feel, many of the players feel. And there are so many unanswered questions, and Dave and I will discuss some of these questions. In another interview, I connect with Mary B. Porter, a former LPGA Tour player who is co-founder of the Hawaii State Junior Golf Association, and we talk about the influence that organization has on junior golfers, including Hawaiian Allison Korpus, who recently won the U.S. Women's Open. And then we visit with Colin Burns, who spent 30 years as the general manager at historic Wingfoot Golf Club in Westchester County. He talks about the Lifetime Achievement Award he won from none other than Prince Albert of Monaco. Hope you enjoy this edition of Sports Interview with Ann Liguori. Busy week in golf, particularly with the Senate hearing earlier this week. And even though there wasn't much new information to come out of it. But if you watched it carefully, I do think we did pick up a lot more than meets the eye. And joining me now to offer his insight on the hearing and other top stories in golf is the one and only Dave Marr. He is the host of six shows on Sirius PGA Tour Radio with a long history of contributions in radio and television. Welcome to Talking Golf, Dave. How are you?
Doing well, Ann. Great to be on your show and looking forward to the chat. Always love chatting.
Yeah, glad you can make time for us. And, you know, overall, I think the Senate hearing was important to kind of get more of a sense about where the PGA Tour is and all of this. The senators, I thought, were well prepared. And, you know, and I think they have every right to ask the questions that they did because golf, like most sports in our country, is an American institution, and we as Americans, I feel, should do everything we can to preserve golf in our country and really not let a foreign entity, be it Saudi Arabia or China or whomever, take over golf and have the biggest financial stake on our turf. What are your overall feelings about all that?
Well, totally agree with you. First of all, I think not only do these senators have the right, but they have the obligation to make sure that an institution like golf is treated fairly from an economic standpoint, and whatever happens as far as the game is concerned, and who runs the upper echelon of the entertainment side of sports. Because, look, at the end of the day, there are 25.6 million golfers in the U.S. 200 of them, maybe 1,000 of them maximum, are going to be impacted by what goes on as far as the LIB, PGA Tour, merger, no merger situations concerned. But to let a foreign agency, especially one that has as tricky a reputation or as sullied a reputation, however you want to look at it, as Saudi Arabia come in and really control what we get to see as far as the game of golf is concerned moving forward, it's something that could disturb the entire kind of underground tenet of the game and what the game is all about. It's always been one that prides itself on, you know, what you mark down on the score is the way you go about being judged in the game, but you also have a certain amount of etiquette you need to play by and unwritten rules as well that need to be adhered to as well. And from my perspective, there are lots of people who like the LIV product, the Saudi Golf League product, with the shotgun starts, the shorts that the pros are wearing, the music, the 54 holes, and that's fine. I mean, some people like Topgolf, and some people like Augusta National, and some people like both. So from my perspective, that's not really my taste. I'm traditional, that having been a PGA champion. So for me, it's important to get to the bottom of how is this partnership going to come together, if it comes together. And if it does the tradition of the game, is that going to be able to be intact, or does the folks with the biggest pocketbook get to control, you know, how we end up seeing the game from here forward? How we all play it, it's all going to stay the same. But what we get to enjoy at the highest levels is something that's been in effect since, you know, the 1930s, 1920s, really, with Walter Hagen and the rest, and my dad when he played on tour in the 1960s. So how's it going to be moving forward? That's a big question mark, and it's one that I don't think was really answered at the Senate hearings, but I do like to see that the Senate and our government is very interested and very protective on what's going to happen.
Absolutely.
And those who are running the game. Yeah, but, and I mean, those who are running and helping the PGA Tour as independent directors, Jimmy Dunn, Ed Herlihy, and the others, have gotten a rap of being very selfish as far as this is concerned. And from my perspective, what I saw there was Jimmy Dunn, who happens to be a friend of mine, you know, trying to protect the game as much as he possibly can and protect the PGA Tour product, which is what I've seen him do on a gratis basis for a long, long time. So
right,
it
and
was
I
very
feel
interesting.
That I feel that Jimmy Dunn and Ron Price, I mean, they did a very good job answering the questions, but sharing the least amount of information possible. And I really don't think they know much more than what they really said. They did. Price was pushed on how much of an investment would come from PIF, and he said north of $1 billion. But, you know, I also thought Senator Richard Blumenthal, he said, my hope is that you will resist the bucket full of money, hoping the PGA Tour will stand up and frankly avoid the sellout that this deal seems to be. He said, if we are going to be selling out to countries that can throw around all kinds of money, that have autocratic regimes torturing their own people, they have mounting evidence that the Saudi government was complicit in 9/11, and he cited other examples. He said, we'll lose our democracy and freedom. And, you know, it worries me that if Saudi Arabia comes in and can kind of, you know, dominate golf in our country financially, that, you know, what's going to stop them or any other countries from doing it with other sports in our country?
No, I totally agree with you, but it's also, it's in some degree happening in other sports, people buying, anyone's allowed to buy an NFL team, but they've got to go through the rigors of the NFL competition committee and all that. As far as the game of golf is concerned, no, I do agree with what you said, but I don't think there was a lot of information for them to share. I mean, there's not a deal memo put together. They've got to take whatever deal they have. I'm talking about the PGA Tour independent directors back to the membership and try and sell them on this being the best situation they can be a part of, the PGA Tour. I will say, back when the tour was formed, and my dad was like the 13th guy on the signature list, you see all the, there's a famous photo of the 100 or so guys that signed from the tour to create the PGA Tour from the PGA of America. And so I've known from the very start what the real tenets of the PGA Tour has been. And it was, look, Jack, Arnold, Gary, Dad, all the rest of them were great golfers. But they wanted businessmen as savvy as they were golfers to run the business side of the tour. And they've gotten that with Ed Herlihy and Jimmy Dunn and over the years, all the exceptional businessmen and golf lovers who understand the importance of the game, but also understand the business side of things. So when they get a deal brought to them, I mean, the people have to listen, the golfers have to listen to the businessmen who are trying to work out the best possible deal for the game and for the PGA Tour members.
Right. Well, I think there have to be other options for the PGA Tour, albeit removing their not-for-profit status, perhaps. But, you know, they came across in the hearings, the PGA Tour, as defeated, I thought, which was sad to me. And basically, they sounded as if they're, you know, damned if they do and damned if they don't. And Jimmy Dunn stressed a few times that if they don't do this deal with the Saudis, then the Saudis would definitely control golf in this country and continue taking the top players with them to live, depleting the PGA Tour of its, you know, top talent. Now, do you think that would be the case, Dave? Or do you have faith in the PGA Tour players that they would remain loyal to the PGA Tour? Because I think that they, you know, based on what the players were saying who did stay with the PGA Tour, I didn't get the sense that they were going to hop, you know, jump over to LIV Golf. Did you?
From what they've said, I've not gotten that sense. But I will tell you that in the past, this has happened a few times throughout history. Jack Nicklaus first, Tom Watson later with Jack, have resisted the undermining of the PGA Tour and what it all means by creating an upper echelon golf tour. Are the modern day pros, do they have the same ethics, the same caring, the same understanding that Jack Arnold did? But I think Arnold and Gary were following Jack's lead. Without Jack Nicklaus, I think that there would have been a better case be made for Arnold and Gary, who were great guys. I enjoyed them both throughout my entire life, but were more prone to follow the buck. Jack was more of a standing on principle kind of a guy. Rory seems to be filling the shoes of Jack. Is everyone going to follow Rory? And I'm talking about Scheffler, Spieth, Justin Thomas, John Rahm from overseas. Will they all follow Rory? That's the important thing. The problem is the PIF, the Public Investment Fund from Saudi Arabia, can offer an amount of money or multiple of money that they weren't able to get back in the days when Jack was saying no. I mean, billions of dollars sent. They could end up, depending upon the appetite of the Saudis and how deep they want this bottomless pit of money they're throwing cash into to be, they could outspend the tour to the point where it would make it very difficult for all but a handful of players to say no. And at that point, are they going to stand on principle and for the rest of their lives not end up competing in where most of the players are going and playing? And what happens with the governing bodies at that point of the world golf rankings with the major championships and all that? All the players that go play for the Saudis, regardless of how they got there, will end up being the de facto main league if they end up getting the lion's share, forget the top few. I think it's going to be a difficult thing to hold the dam there once they start going. Everyone that seems to have gone now, to me, it was kind of a dented, you know, a scratch and dent kind of a crew, you know, with Brooks Koepka, who was injured, Dustin Johnson, who was unmotivated, Patrick Reed, who has his problems with the rules, and all the people that took over to Saudi, to the Saudi league prior to, weren't really the standard bearers of the game. If they get a few of those guys, when Cam Smith went, if they get a couple of the big name players for, how do you turn down $500 million? It's going to be a very tricky thing for the PGA Tour to hold those players back on principle. They can't hold them back from a legal perspective, but for those to have the same kind of ethics and integrity for the tour that Rory McIlroy has, who this week said, I'd retire before playing LIV. I don't think there are as many guys there as we'd like to see. I hope you're right, though, and I'm wrong.
Well, there are, you know, the documents then that were turned over to the Senate before the hearing. And one of the requests was that Yasser Al-Rumayyan receive a membership to Augusta National. which I thought was laughable. What was your thoughts when you heard?
I could send you a memo saying, you know, I'd like to have a, or an email saying I'd like you to have a membership at Augusta National. It doesn't mean anything. He's not going to have a membership at Augusta National. Has all to do with Augusta National, nothing to do with the PGA Tour. And to me, it's a laughable request or hope that I think was dangled out there as a possibility that really wasn't a possibility. I mean, for Augusta National to get themselves involved in this mix and mess, which they've never done on any tour, again, you know as well as anybody else, Augusta National, the PGA of America, the Royal and Ancient Golf Club of St. Andrews, and the USGA, the governing bodies for all four of the major championships, have nothing to do with the PGA Tour. They look at the PGA Tour as the tour that helps identify which players are most eligible or qualified for exemptions into their event. The Open Championship and the U.S. Open have qualifying, which used to include past champions, like the immediate past champion used to have to qualify for those championships. So Augusta National, I think that probably caught them by surprise, even though there are those with strong ties to Augusta National in the conversation. It was never going to happen that way. Just never.
Just crazy request. And
yeah.
PGA Tour Commissioner Jay Monahan will return to work tomorrow, basically, after that undisclosed medical leave. I guess the big question is, will the tour players trust him? Because a lot of them said it would be hard to at this point.
Well, and a lot of them said it would be hard to right when the information came down. I'm a big Jay Monahan fan. I've got a lot of friends and people who I know, colleagues that work at the PGA Tour, and they've loved him as a hands-on operator and leader, which was dissimilar to from Pete, Tim Fincham and prior to that, Beeman. But how do you trust the guy when the betrayal becomes, you know, public information and everyone starts saying, hang on one second, I really feel like I've been sold out here. And then the guy goes, I understand that there you have medical issues and all those things. I'm not sure what happened with Jay in that month, but you disappear almost immediately at the absolute most important time in the history of your entire organization for a month as the leader. I don't know how you survive that.
Right. Strange goings on. That's for sure. Well, I'm glad he is healthy and coming back to work. We're out of time, unfortunately, Dave. It goes so fast. But before I let you go, who are you picking to win the Open Championship, which starts Thursday already?
It starts immediately. That's right. Look, Jon Rahm is always such a force in the game. I'd like to see him continue his major championship sweep, trying to get all four. But I like Scottie Scheffler. I just think he's going to think his way around the golf course. It's going to be a lot of fun to watch this Open Championship. Hoy Lake, a very unique Open Championship venue. You can try power, but the brains always help you around this place. So I'm going with Scheffler.
And the last to win there, none other than Rory McIlroy, who right now is 13 under. You know, the Scottish Open is going on. They had to get the tee times earlier this morning because of inclement weather forecast, and he right now is one back at 13 under behind Robert McIntyre, a Scotsman. Anyway, Dave, thanks so much. Always a pleasure. You know, whether you're talking golf or picking out music as a DJ at your parties, it's always fun to spend time with you.
Thanks, Annie. Always love seeing you and talking to you.
Take care, Dave Marr. Welcome back. My guest is Mary B. Porter, former LPGA Tour player spanning two decades, co-founder of the Hawaii State Junior Golf Association, five-year member of the PGA of America Rules Committee, serves on the USGA Junior Amateur Committee, served on the USGA Executive Committee. Wow. Mary B. has been so involved in golf on so many levels, and it's an honor to have you on Talking Golf. Welcome to the show, Mary B.
Good morning, Anne. It's always wonderful to see you and hear all you're doing to promote the game of golf. So you're one of my favorites.
Aren't you sweet for saying? I truly appreciate that. And well, let's start with, you must have just been overjoyed with Allison Korapus's U.S. Women's Open win. I mean, she is from Hawaii and you're based in Hawaii.
Well, she is a young lady that I think the world of golf kind of knew, or the smaller world of golf around Hawaii. Obviously, everyone knew Allison, and USC. She was, you know, went to USC as a Trojan. So everyone was pretty aware of her, and the USGA was aware as she competed in so many USGA championships as a young player, and which is something that I always promote, is to try to get our kids. You can't win a national championship unless you enter it. So, and Allison entered them. I think she played in 19 USGA championships. So I'm very aware of Allison, and I've known her since she was 7 years old.
And she shot a 369 in the final round to win by three shots. And it was her very first professional title, right? A major championship.
Right. And she had done well earlier this year too, you know, where she was in contention. And I think she learned from her mistakes, as we all make, or not necessarily mistakes. I think you all have to go through that and to figure out how do you react under stress. And it's funny because one of the things I always tell my parents in junior golf is that my job is to make your child uncomfortable. And they look at me like, what are you talking about? And I said, well, we don't grow in our comfort. We only grow in our discomfort. And I really work on that to make them feel a little uncomfortable and so that they can grow. And Allison's done that. And she's always pushed herself in playing above her age level. And I won't necessarily above her ability, but she's always pushed herself to be in an uncomfortable situation. So she's obviously learned a lot from that. Watching her play in the US Open last week was crazy.
So give me some examples, because that's very interesting and very effective, obviously. How do you put junior golfers in some uncomfortable scenarios so that they can learn to deal with all kind of adversity?
So my goal, like I said, I even from the beginning when they arrive and they show up at registration, I try to have new faces there all the time, because a lot of kids will just come to registration and, oh, there's Anne. She knows it's me and I don't have to tell her my name and I don't have to do anything. And I put them there and they'll stand in front of somebody and finally the person will say, do you have a name or can you tell me? And they're like, oh, okay. And they're a little edgy, a little uncomfortable. And then also when I start them on the first tee, I have someone announcing them to make them feel a little edgy, because it's when you get into a major championship, like a US Open or a Women's Open or any USGA championship or any national championship, they're announcing you on the tee. And if you don't understand how your body works at that moment, I remember my first US Open, I don't think I could get the ball to stay on the tee, you know, and your heart rate's so high and you have to learn that. And it comes with experience. And I think she's continually tested herself through the years and performed.
Yeah, controlling those nerves in so many different situations is key. And yes, she looked so unflappable and unfazed, almost to the extent of, I was wondering if she even knew that she had won at the end of the final round, because initially she didn't really look so happy, you know?
And that's a little bit who she is. She's never shown much emotion, even as a young child. She used to have a little two-wheeled cart. I kept saying three-wheeled, but it was a two-wheeled little pull cart. And she had it all the way through junior golf, and she played in some PGA Junior Series championships, the PGA Junior Championship, and she brought that little two-wheeled pull cart. And you couldn't tell if she was shooting 100 or she was shooting 60, and which is great. I think it's a great temperament to have. I'm sure inside, internally, she was grinding, and what she said, she was nervous. Of course she was nervous. You have to be nervous. Any player's nervous, but it's a matter of figuring out how to calm those nerves and understand that, geez, I'm full of adrenaline right now and I better club back. I can't hit this 9-iron. I better be hitting a wedge, which sounds stupid in numbers, but you know, when you get so much adrenaline and you have to figure out what does your body do and how do you react to it. So I know I agree.
You co-founded the Hawaii State Junior Golf Association. Can you give us some background on the role that you and this association have played, not only with Allison's game, but with junior golfers in Hawaii?
Someone like Michelle Wee, you mean, too, who is one of my other U.S. Open winners. So when I basically was reaching retirement on tour, I had gone on to the USGA Junior Girls Committee in 93, I believe. And it's something I never thought I would do. And I had to take rules tests and I had to do all these things. And I discovered that I was an idiot as far as rules were concerned. And I had married and moved over here when my son was six, and I was sort of ending my career. I played very few tournaments through the 90s. But I saw how little Hawaii had for our kids. And I grew up in Southern California, where we had a tournament. I could play in three tournaments a week. They might have been one day tournaments, but there was a tournament and you teed it up and you paid your $2 and you got your lunch and a drink, and you're at the golf course all day, and somebody would drop you off and you'd be picked up at dark. But I had that opportunity. And I think that Hawaii didn't have that. And obviously for some good reasons, we are an island state, which is very unique. So we had to figure out a way to overcome some of those challenges. And so as I got near retirement, I really felt sorry for a lot of our kids here, because you're not going to be good playing three tournaments a year. And you're not going to have opportunities that other kids on the mainland would have just with three tournaments a year. So we started, we formed the Hawaii State Junior Golf Association in 1998. And I was soon the president, and I'm still the president of it. But I actually was the chief bottle washer as well. I did everything. And I was, you know, going from tournament to tournament, running tournaments, and especially when Allison was young and Michelle was young, Michelle Wee. And I really tried to just give them as many opportunities. And this was a little bit before 9/11. We had one day tournaments where you could fly to another island. And at that time, it was very inexpensive. And we had a bus to pick them up and we took them to the course. And we even got national rankings for those, which, due to some friends, Matt Clare with Junior Golf Scoreboard helped me there. So our kids got ranked. And because otherwise they couldn't. For them to afford to go play an AJGA tournament, it cost the family $5,000 to go up there and or just to go qualify. And we did work out some exemptions with AJGA. So I was very involved and I'm actually more involved right now, just because of after COVID, it's been so difficult to get staffing. So, but my whole goal was to give these kids just an opportunity, and they're going to have to do the work. They're going to have to practice. They're going to have to spend the time if they want to be good. And one of the things that I did, especially with our girls, I knew a lot of college coaches. I know a lot of college coaches because many of them played the tour with me. And they would call me and ask me, can your Hawaii kids, can they hit it anywhere? Do they have distance? And at that time, they really didn't, because no one was pushing them. And my goal was to push them, make them uncomfortable. Okay. And if for some reason, I don't think a 10-year-old should be hitting 18 greens and two putting and shooting par. I know I certainly didn't. I know how thrilled I was when I made my first par, you know, and it was difficult. And you strove to be a par shooter. So I did that, and I lengthened the courses on them and for the boys as well. And I challenged them, and they met that challenge. And they've all met challenges. You know, these aren't our first national champions, because we had Kimberly Kim won the women's amateur. Kyung Kim won the Pub Links, you know, and Michelle won the Pub Links, and Casey Watabu won the Pub Links and beat Anthony Kim. So we've had a lot of great successes through the years. And those isn't why I do it, Ann. I do it really to get these kids an education as well, to get them off island, to see something else in the world. And if they bring that education back to Hawaii, that's a bonus. But also to give them just the gift of golf. And I was given that gift at age seven. And I just feel very compelled to continue to give that gift in that I was given by Betty Hicks, who was my first teacher. And to teach them the right way, the etiquette, the things that I feel we're missing in the game right now, but to teach them a game for a lifetime. And I think we've been pretty successful out here.
Certainly have. Michelle Wee was on Talking Golf a few weeks ago, and she actually talked about trying to play as many tournaments as she can, including PGA Tour events that were on the islands, because getting to the mainland was so expensive and really not possible at that age. So it was interesting how, you know, all these opportunities came up, which are so needed. You've officiated over 100 U.S. national championships. So share exactly what that means at these national champions. What exactly do you do?
What do I do? Well, it used to be that the USGA or the British Open, the different national championships, you walked with a group. And so, which I enjoyed, because then you're right there. You could see what happened. You could see where the ball crossed the penalty area. You could see where it went out of bounds, or you could see where it entered to go search. And you were really involved. And right before COVID, actually, they switched it to where you're actually stationary on a hole. At Augusta, that was the same thing, too. At Augusta, I was fortunate to officiate there for 5 years. And you're assigned a hole. And depending on what year you are, and you have to have a score. You have to, you know, at that time you had to have a 92 score out of 100 and a two-hour test or 4 hour. I don't know how long the test is. It seems like it's forever. And to be able to give rulings. And I've been doing that, and I've been very fortunate that I've officiated at Augusta, and I officiated at the Open, the British Open at St. Andrews, and the RNA was so kind to give me Jack Nicklaus on his Thursday round, his last round last week at St. Andrews. So, and so you're there to make the call. And, you know, sometimes you better know your stuff. It's that all of a sudden the camera's in your face and a microphone and they're listening to you, and you just hope to goodness you get it right. But, you know, it from coming from a player side, I feel that I've had a little bit of an up with that, because I understand what the player's going through. I understand that a player does not want to hear a rules number. They just want to know how to get out of jail. And I've had to ask that question many times in my life as a player. You know, I don't want to know. Just tell me how I get out of here. What do I do? And if they ask me, what are my options? I'm going to tell them all their options, because sometimes we don't think about that when you're in the heat of the moment. You don't think about, oh, geez, I never thought I could go over there. That's a better option. So to all your listeners, just ask your rules official, what are my options? And you'll get all the options and maybe find a better one.
And you have to really know. I mean, there's so much to know in the rules of golf. And you have to really be on, as you say, because there's national TV cameras in your face at any given moment. And ironically, in the final round, you had to make a calling for Alison Corpuz as well at the U.S. Women's Open.
I did. And it was funny, because obviously they were my last group. I was on hole five, the par three. And as the media comes, probably 75 different media from camera and, you know, every which way, they sort of blocked my view of the green where I was sitting. And I figured Hasa had hit it in the bunker and she had knocked it out. I saw she was safe. And then I knew Alison was on the side of the green. And the next thing I know, kind of like in unison, everyone turns and looks at me. And I'm like, what? They need a ruling on the green. I go, oh, great. So anyway, I go up there and it's Alison. And you know, at that point, I'm just holding my breath for her, because it's such a big stage. And it's and there's so many things that can happen, especially at Pebble Beach. It's a difficult, difficult golf course. And I think she felt comfortable, because obviously it's Mary B's there. And it's like, oh, hi, Mary B. And hi, Alison. You know, and I've been giving her rulings since a little girl. And I remember one particular ruling that she had dropped it in the wrong place. But anyway, where she did get penalized, but she's taken that well. But I gave her the ruling, and we walked through it, and off I went, and I still held my breath till the very end to make sure she got there.
And so, she continued completely unfazed, which was so true to character, and one of the reasons why she's the U.S. Women's Open champion.
The Met Golf Writers Association, of which I've been a board member, a proud board member for years, as you know, Mary B., presents the Mary B. Porter Humanitarian Award at their National Awards Dinner, honoring an individual who, through a heroic or humanitarian act, saves or betters the lives of others. And this award dates back to 1989, a year after you saved a drowning boy's life. Can you share that heroic story? Just incredible.
Well, I can give you the cliff notes of it. At that point, it was a qualifying tournament, and I was on, at that point, it was the 13th hole, and it's the fourth hole the way Moon Valley plays it, but our 13th hole in qualifying. And I hit a good drive, I popped my drive up, so it eliminated me going for the green. So I had to lay up, and when I did, I pulled it dead left. And no yardages, no nothing over there, no sprinkler heads. So I walked up to the green from there. It ended up being 101 yards. And as I walked back, I saw a man fully clothed jump into a pool. And as I looked more, I saw a baby floating on the top of the pool face down. And for whatever reason, I decided I should be involved. And this little boy, as it ended up being, a year younger than my son at the time. So he was 3, my son was 4. And so I finally got my caddy's attention to come, and he threw me over the fence, and the father had gone in the water hand and got him out, shook him upside down, which is not a good thing for drowning, and handed him to me with no life in him at all. And I could tell you every heartbeat and every breath I took during that time, but through luck and God's will, they were an Amish family that had hired a driver in a motorhome to drive them to visit their cousins that the fathers grew up together, who was no longer practicing the Amish lifestyle. And they'd all left for the day. And the little Jonathan walked right down the steps, walked in the pool, and came up floating. And so I was very fortunate, through lots of trial and error with him, to resuscitate him and get life back in him. And I didn't know any compressions, and I ended up slugging him, and I did mouth to mouth, and I did everything that I could think of. But Jonathan just turned, his birthday was just a couple of weeks ago. I hate to tell you, he turned 39, and he just had his fourth child. So we're still in touch. The Met Golf Writers were kind. If you were there, they brought him out not long after that the award was given, and the PGA flew him in when I received the First Lady of Golf Award through the PGA, and surprised me to bring him out. And so he's a wonderful young man. He's no longer practicing the Amish lifestyle, but he was the baby, the youngest of 7 children, and just the most delightful young man, and now has 4 children of his own. And he shoes racehorses. That's his job. And loves it, and he's right busy in season. So thank you for asking.
Unbelievable. You are a true hero, not only to golfers, but non-golfers as well. And, you know, the world needs more mentors like yourself. Thank you for all you do, Mary B., and, you know, for being a mentor and for saving people's lives and for doing all you do for junior golf. It's just extraordinary. And I can't thank you enough for being on. Thanks so much.
Anytime. Thank you, Anne.
Many of you in golf know Colin Burns. He was the general manager at Wingfoot in Westchester, New York for 30 years before becoming chief operating officer at the Apogee Club in Hobe Sound, Florida, with 3 signature courses and villas being built. And most recently, Colin received the 2023 Lifetime Achievement Award from the Monaco U.S. Celebrity Golf Cup by Prince Albert of Monaco. Congratulations, Colin.
That sounds exhausting, Anne. Good morning. How are you?
Wow. Well, you've had a very long and storied career, so I had to give you a little bit of your due here. But man, you travel in some high circles for sure.
I have to tell you, of all the things that I did at Wingfoot in the 31 years, you know, hosting a couple of major championships, PGA championship, all kinds of things, the event that was just held in Monaco was off the charts. Wonderful, fabulous. Great group of people, American athletes, Josh Scobie. There were some European rugby players. One of the Pussycat Dolls was there, a collection of uber-wealthy, fun people. And Prince Albert himself, Anne, was absolutely charming.
Nice. What an honor. Lifetime Achievement Award. So did you play golf with Prince Albert?
I did not. Actually, Prince Albert joined us for the formal dinner, the black tie dinner at the Hermitage. He presented the award that was co-hosted by Pascal Grisot. And Anne, you may know Pascal. He was the chairman of the 2018 Ryder Cup in Paris.
Right.
And Pascal and I met in 1995 when he was first playing in the Anderson tournament at Wingfoot Golf Club, which he ultimately won in 1997.
I love that. So yeah. Tell us the U.S. Celebrity Golf Cup. What is it?
Well, this is started by a woman named Susan Feaster. And Susan is a resident of Monaco. She's a U.S. citizen. Her husband was a decorated Army, I believe, colonel. And after his passing, she decided that she wanted to, you know, remain active in sort of the social circle, the world of golf. She became friends through some friends with Prince Albert. He has a charity that is primarily focused on sustaining the oceanic environment of Monaco. So the two of them got together. Ultimately, Pascal Grisot got involved as the chairman of the 2018 Ryder Cup. They convinced him that it would be a good idea. And he was the first Lifetime Achievement Award winner because of the efforts he made in putting basically France on the map in terms of golf. So the idea, you know, was spawned from that. They raised money. They have multiple European sponsors. And so ultimately it's a charity that benefits the ocean surrounding Monaco and Prince Albert's you know, charity related to that.
That's nice. So is that at a course near there? Or?
Well, actually what we did, and to make this even more of a whirlwind, is that we flew into Nice, went 2 hours into Italy, near a town called Alessio, lovely, lovely inn that we stayed at. There was 2 days of golf there, and then we hopped on a shuttle, arrived in Monaco late in the afternoon, got settled in there, had a lovely dinner at this fabulous estate that's right on the water. It was just absolutely stunning. And then the next day was the dinner, and then home.
It's
set up in a Ryder Cup format, which is a lot of fun. So the Europeans versus the Americans, and ultimately the Europeans won, just like the 2018 Ryder Cup. So it was sort of sad for us, but it was a great time for everyone.
I know years ago I had the opportunity to play the Monte Carlo Golf Club, and
yes.
That was fun. And then recently we were on this golf cruise. Believe it or not, it's actually this Costa golf cruise, and you can kind of select a golf excursion if you'd like.
Huh.
And we played in Aix-en-Provence, but we also played Marco Simone outside of Rome where the Ryder Cup's going to be.
Oh, how was that?
Oh, my gosh.
Really?
I loved it. It's a really fun golf course. I think as a venue for the Ryder Cup, it's going to be real exciting. Yeah.
That's great. As a matter of fact, a guy, and I'm going to blank on his last name, I apologize, the chairman of the 2023 Ryder Cup was with us as well at the dinner.
Right.
Pascal's counterpart. You know, what's funny, speaking of these fabulous European golf clubs, we visited what may be the most unique place I've ever been to, Vidabon Golf Club. Hmm. And they have 30 members. Super exclusive, a fabulously designed golf course that was done by Robert Trent Jones Sr. way back in the day, and it's in the middle of what looks like a nature preserve. There's donkey on the property. There's these fabulous tortoises that they have emblazoned their logo with, and it's really what a place. And that was about, I'd say, an hour out of Nice in a town called Vidabon.
30 members?
30 members.
I love that.
I think from somebody who managed a much larger facility than that for all those years,
yeah.
the idea of 30 is just dreamy.
Well, speaking of 30, I mean, 30 years you served as GM at Wingfoot. So tell me, do you miss it, Colin?
Oh, I miss it all the time. And
I'm
it's
sure.
One of the most, I mean, you know, you've been there plenty of times. It's such a special place. And, you know, I wonder sometimes, like, you know, it's still sort of new to me. By the way, I love what I'm doing at Apogee. This is a fabulous, and we can talk about that later. It's a fabulous facility. But in terms of Wingfoot, I do. I miss the people. I miss the people who I worked with, you know, guys and gals who I was with for 30 years, watched them grow, watched their children grow. Same with the members. You know, it becomes a very close relationship. And so I think I miss that most of all is the people, and I really do miss the action, you know, being at the front door like I always was for all those years, greeting everyone. And so, yeah, it is still a little bit bittersweet, but it will remain a part of me. I spent half my life there, literally.
Wow.
So it will remain very, very close to me for forever.
And you were the executive director for the 97 PGA Championships. Then they had the 2004 US-AM, the 2006 2020 US Open Championships, which I covered all those. And what highlights stand out of all those major events in your, you must have such an extensive memory bank, but what highlight stands out?
I think, I mean, besides Ryan Moore coming back from a deficit to win the 2004 U.S. Amateur, from a golf perspective, that was really special. I think from an emotional perspective, I can still close my eyes and see Phil and Amy and Bones in the locker room at Wingfoot after having lost the 2006 U.S. Open. And that remains one of those memories, both, you know, both good and bad, having gotten to know Phil during the week. But such a disastrous ending. I think that's probably one of the things that I will reflect back on a lot, because it was, we'd got to know each other. He was so gracious leading up to the event. He would always call before coming, you know, went for practice rounds, just super gracious. And we spent time during the week, which really was a lot of fun. We had dinner together, and, you know, he really felt that it was his to win. And when it didn't happen, it was, I think I took it very personally. I really took it to heart.
Sure. I mean, nobody can, you know, forget that. That 2006 U.S. Open, he needed a par in the 18th to win, ended up double bogeying the final hole, used driver off the tee. The ball ended up, it's painful to even go through it, right? The ball ended up in the hospitality tent.
Oh my gosh.
Next shot hit the tree. I mean, just crazy. And Jeff Ogilvy ended up with the victory, and you know, Phil had yet to win a U.S. Open, which would have completed a career Grand Slam for him. But, you know, reading up on all that, he later said that his play in that final round was his single greatest short game performance of his career. He struck the ball terribly, but he still had a chance to win the U.S. Open. So until that final hole, it's just crazy.
He did. And, you know, for me, as still, you know, relatively young man at that time, I think the lesson I learned was the graciousness with which he addressed the crowd. You know, after the cameras went off and people were sort of, you know, shutting their TVs off at home, he came out to accept the, you know, the silver medal. And it was the manner in which he did that I think, as I close my eyes, I can remember how gracious he wasn't bitter. He actually apologized, you know, and this wasn't covered. So
I remember that, yeah.
There, you know, I mean, those of us who were there or inside sort of the rope, so to speak, saw that. And to me, it really stuck in my mind. You know, and afterwards, we sent Phil a gift. I had the members. I left something at the front desk. We had over 400 signatures, and it was beautiful gold leaf and this iconic sort of, you know, calligraphy. And I sent it to him, and it was about great sportsmanship, being a great sport in sportsmanship, and so being a gentleman. And I found this quote from the 1800s. It's beautifully done. So I sent it to him. I don't hear back from him. And he finally called me at home. He'd gotten my home phone number, and the conversation we had, and once again, typical Phil, he was apologizing and being very gracious, thanked us for the gift, the most lovely gift he'd ever received. And it was just that whole, I think all of those events, you know, sort of, you know, have formed in my mind this both good and bad, bittersweet memory of 2006.
Sure, and I can't believe I remember this, but back in 97, I can remember exactly where that media tent was. And I was doing updates every 20 minutes back then for WFAN. And then in 2020, the U.S. Open then, it was eerie, right? Because there were no spectators during COVID. And, you know, you're walking around and the only people there were those who were working. And then, of course, Bryson DeChambeau hitting long bombs off the tee, blasting those short irons, and he wins it. So a lot of fun memories. Not that, you know, that was a little different 2020, but boy, yeah. You've experienced it all, right?
Yeah, you know, moving, that was, you know, one of those things people have asked a lot about when I'm, you know, I'm out, whatever, doing some, you know, at a social event or a meeting of some kind, and what that was like. Well, I can remember I was sitting right where I am now, and it was March 13th, and the vendors were just about to start building the tents. And we had gone through great pains for five previous years between the security, New York State Police, the governor's office. I mean, the things that we had laid out, we thought we had such a fabulous plan. 45,000 people would be there, you know, in total. And we were on this phone call, and it was John Bodenhammer, very, very respected and dear colleague at the USGA. And it was, you know, the Brian Marsal, who was the chairman of the U.S. Open, and some others. And we said, guys, we can't do this. We can't build these tents, have them empty, kill all this turf, you know, deconstruct everything. It's just not going to happen. And that was one of those moments where we all, you know, breathed this heartfelt sigh of, it was sort of a, you know, this pang in our hearts that we had worked so hard to, you know, rejuvenate the relationship with the USGA, get another U.S. Open scheduled, and then to have it all just sort of vaporize. And then what we did was the next several months, we were on a weekly phone call trying to figure out the Masters schedule, when they were going to schedule, the NFL schedule, because suddenly, you know, we realized we were being pushed into the fall. And it was one of those things that we worked together. And, you know, Ann, I think to me, again, one of those really fond memories was the way the USGA, Wingfoot Golf Club, the executive committee, and people outside of our particular, you know, sort of realm, worked together to make that fall happen. And while it wasn't great, you know, we had to keep resubmitting plans to the governor's office, 10,000 people. Then it became 5,000 people. Then it became basically zero. It was, you know, 450 member volunteers, people from the press, players, and the whole bubble concept. You know, no one could come into the clubhouse except players. So their managers, family, caddies, no one come in except in a handful of staff members. So from our perspective, it was kind of fun to be having breakfast next to, you know, Matt Fitzpatrick, and we saw, you know, Adam Scott every afternoon, and it was very intimate. And yes, there was certainly something eerie about it, but it was nonetheless a great U.S. Open. Bryson definitely proved that he was the better man, you know, during that period. And I still run into him from time to time. You know, we had a great homecoming with him a year later. And we flew him up from Liberty National up the Hudson in a helicopter. We had a ball. We had 500 people waiting for him, and he put on a clinic for the kids and signed every piece of paper handed to him. And it really was a great homecoming for a guy who, frankly, you know, a lot of Wingfoot members didn't know, and some of them, you know, didn't necessarily you know, weren't thrilled about him winning, not for any other reason except they didn't know who he was.
Sure.
And when he came home, if you will, to Wingfoot that next year, it was nothing short of spectacular.
Yeah, he is a very nice guy and has gotten a bad rap in the past, but yep. I know he means well. Anyway, Colin, we're out of time. I know you're the chief operating officer at a very exclusive new private facility called the Apogee. I want you to come back on in the very near future and tell us all about it. But congratulations on this Lifetime Achievement Award. It's just so well-deserved. And boy, we'll have you on again, Colin Burns. Thanks so much for joining us this morning on Talkin' Golf.
Dan, thank you so much. Bye-bye.
My thanks to Colin Burns, to Mary B. Porter, to Dave Marr, and to My Good Sound Production. As Winston Churchill once said, success is not final. Failure is not fatal. It is the courage to continue that counts. Have a great weekend, everybody. Be safe, be nice. And I look forward to talking with you next Saturday morning right here on Sports Interview with Ann LaGorrie.